Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 10th, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is analyzing the new proposed rule defining waters of the United States. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are very fortunate to have with us Ms. Deidre Duncan, who is a partner at Hunton, Anders & Kurth. Also with us is Mr. Tony Francois, who is a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. And moderating our panel today is Mr. Darren Baxt, who is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. So after our speakers give their remarks today, we will have an audience Q&A, so please keep in mind what questions you have for this topic, for one of our speakers, you name it. So please keep in mind what you'll be asking. Thank you very much for sharing with us today. Darren, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Wes. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank everyone for calling in today and also those listening to the podcast. So what waters can the EPA and the Corps regulate under the Clean Water Act? That's a question that's been hard for the agencies to answer. So under the Clean Water Act, the agencies can regulate navigable waters. And the statute explains that the term navigable waters means the waters of the United States, including the territorial seas. So therefore, much of the focus is on defining what does waters of the United States mean? And that's precisely the question that the EPA and Corps are trying to answer in the proposed rule that we're going to be discussing today. So courts don't usually shoot down environmental regulations, in large part because of the significant deference given to federal agencies. Yet in both 2001 and 2006, the U.S. Supreme Court did just that. They shot down agency interpretations of waters in the United States. And those cases were Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County versus Army Corps of Engineers and Rapanos versus United States. So over the years, the agencies have taken a very expansive view of their power under the Clean Water Act. Instead of trying to stay well within what is authorized by law, the agencies have continued to interpret waters in the United States very broadly. The Obama administration's 2015 Clean Water Rule that also sought to define waters in the United States is kind of a prime example of this overreach. Now, there have been some consistent problems with EPA and Corps regulations and enforcement for decades regarding waters of the U.S. And these problems, I should clarify, definitely didn't just start with the 2015 Clean Water Rule. The agencies have tried to regulate almost every water imaginable instead of regulating the waters that are clearly within the scope of the law. They failed to respect the primary role the states are supposed to play in addressing water pollution under the Clean Water Act. They've also created vague and subjective definitions on so that property owners don't know how to comply, and they may even forgo activities like farming just out of fear of civil and criminal penalties. And the list of problems could go on. There is some good news, and that's the new proposed rule does appear to recognize many of these past problems and looks to be a step, at least in the right direction. There are certainly some good things in the proposed rule, but as would be expected, there are definitely some areas for improvement. And so before I forget, for those interested in providing comments on the proposed rule, the deadline for comments to the EPA and the Corps is this Monday coming up, which is April 15th. So now I want to turn it over to Deidre and Tony, who will provide us their perspective on the proposed rule. And I'm going to first turn it to Deidre. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Darren. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to folks today. And before delving into the actual language and my thoughts on some of the provisions in the proposed 2019 rule, I just wanted to emphasize a point that you made, which is really why clarity in this issue on Clean Water Act jurisdiction matters so much. And first and foremost, the public needs to understand how to comply with the Clean Water Act. Ambiguity that's existed for many years in the Clean Water Act only increases the potential that the public can unwittingly take actions that they think are compliance with the law, but then later it results in enforcement by EPA and the Corps, resulting in potential civil and criminal penalties, as you said, which can include jail. So this is a serious matter for the public. the issue of the scope of jurisdiction, you know, also impacts whether you need to ask the government for a permit, and if so, what type of permit. The scope of federal jurisdiction affects the scope of many other requirements, like NEPA, the Endangered Species Act, and the National Historic Preservation Act. Ambiguity on this issue, you know, on the scope of what waters are regulated, often delays projects and activities, resulting in huge costs to the public. So, you know, this is an important issue, and clarity is the key. So what exactly does the 2019 proposed rule cover? The 2019 rule identifies six categories of waters of the United States. Category A1 includes the traditional navigable waters. Category A2 covers tributaries, which include perennial and intermittent streams, but not ephemeral streams, and Tony will discuss more on that category in a minute. Category A3, which is a new category, it covers ditches constructed in a tributary or adjacent wetlands, in accordance with the rule's new definitions of those terms, and that meet the new tributary definition. Category A4, which is also a new category, lakes and ponds. Category A5, impoundments. And category A6, adjacent wetlands. The rule also identifies categories of waters that are not waters of the United States, and those include features that were not identified in those previous categories A through 6. So any feature not identified in A through 6 should be excluded. Groundwater, ephemeral features, ditches not identified in the ditch category A3, prior converted cropland, artificially irrigated areas, artificial lakes and ponds, water-filled depressions created in upland incidental to mining or construction, stormwater control features excavated or constructed in uplands to convey, treat, infiltrate, or store stormwater runoff, wastewater recycling structures constructed in uplands, and waste treatment systems. So obviously there's a lot that we could discuss about all those issues and all those categories, but today I'm going to focus first on category A1, the traditional navigable waters. Really, the scope of what is a traditional navigable water is of fundamental importance for this proposal, because most all of the other categories are tied to that, to their relationship with the traditional navigable waters. They're deemed jurisdictional based upon their relationship to what is a traditional navigable water. This category includes those waters, quote, which are currently used or were used in the past or may be susceptible to use in interstate or foreign commerce, including the territorial seas and waters which are subject to the ebb and flow of the tide. So the agencies are not proposing to make changes to this existing regulatory text. The language that I read you is essentially the existing regulatory text. However, they do consolidate the territorial seas into this category. However, there are significant concerns with this regulatory text that I think is important to highlight today and discuss. The preamble to the 2019 rule recognizes that an evaluation of whether a water qualifies as a TNW is rooted in the test for navigability under the Rivers and Harbors Act, articulated by the Supreme Court in the Daniel Ball versus United States and its progeny. The Daniel Ball cases and its progeny define navigable waters for Rivers and Harbors Act purposes as those that, one, are navigable in fact, and two, together with other waters, form waterborne highways used to transport goods in interstate or foreign commerce. This test, the Daniel Ball test, was recognized by the plurality and Justice Kennedy in the Rapanos decision. They both based their jurisdictional tests on what they referred to as the traditional navigable waters and navigable waters in the traditional sense. In recent years, though, and in particular with the publication of something called Appendix D to the 2007 Rapanos guidance, the agencies have given traditional navigable waters a broader and broader interpretation, allowing waterways that are merely used in commerce rather than used for the transportation of commercial goods in interstate commerce to be considered traditional navigable waters. So this concept of used in commerce versus transporting goods in interstate commerce is very significant. Appendix D, for example, sets forth an interpretation that traditional navigable water categories could include any water that is currently being used for recreation, for example, boat rentals, fishing trips, water skiing. These interpretations are really far afield from the traditional notion of what constitutes a navigable water in the traditional sense under the Rivers and Harbors Act. One of the comments that a lot of folks will be making is that it's important to return to that traditional understanding of navigability, and that the agencies should amend the proposed regulatory text to read waters which are currently used or were used in the past or may be susceptible to transport interstate or foreign commerce, including the territorial seas and waters which are subject to the ebb and flow of the tide. So replacing used in or use in with transport. In addition, the agencies should revise or better withdraw Appendix D. And finally, it's important to note that just because a water is not deemed a traditional navigable water or an A1 water does not mean that it can't be regulated under one of the other categories, such as tributaries or lakes or ponds. It just means it's not one of these foundational A1 waters. I'm now going to turn it over to Tony, who's going to talk about, I believe, tributaries and adjacent wetlands.
Thank you, Deirdre. In talking about tributaries and adjacent wetlands, I think the starting point for thinking about these two categories is that they may be the most common way that EPA and the Army Corps, follow the water uphill from traditionally navigable, in fact, rivers and lakes, as Deirdre just described, up into more remote areas, smaller water bodies. In fact, water features that are only there perhaps a few weeks or months out of the year. So I'll start this with a quick history lesson of both the 1986 and the 2015 regulations and how they treated tributaries and adjacent wetlands to see what the changes are in the 2019 proposal. The 1986 regulations were actually pretty simple. They just included all tributaries and all adjacent wetlands. Adjacent was broadly defined as bordering, contiguous, or neighboring. And in practice, this was very much a qualitative measure. You know, what was bordering, what was contiguous, what was neighboring. 2006, the Supreme Court, in the case Rapanos versus the United States, invalidated both of these categories as beyond the scope of the term navigable waters in the Clean Water Act. The failure of the regulations in this regard was its universal or global application to all tributaries and all adjacent wetlands. And this is despite significant differences in rationale and even what they thought the proper scope of the act is between the four-member plurality, for whom the late Justice Scalia wrote, and a concurrence authored by Justice Kennedy. Both the plurality and the concurrence agree on two things. Some non-navigable tributaries and wetlands are regulable under the Act, but not all of them. It's this view that some but not all waters beyond the traditionally navigable waters are regulated that has been the source of a lot of difficulty since then for the regulated community, for the agencies, for the courts, because you have to figure out where on this continuum from navigable, in fact, rivers to, you know, small isolated ponds and whatnot, the Act actually authorizes regulation. In the years since 2006, Justice Kennedy's rationale, which is expressed in a complex multi-factor significant nexus test, has been adopted by the agencies and by all the circuit courts to have looked at the issue as the controlling rule for determining which tributaries and wetlands are regulated. And I should note that the agencies and some of the lower courts allow the agencies to establish authority under either the Kennedy concurrence or the Scalia plurality. In 2015, as an effort to resolve a lot of the confusion over what was covered and what wasn't, but I would say also in an exercise of rather a rather broad assertion of regulatory authority, the Obama administration adopted new regulations that replaced the 1986 regs. And these the 2015 regulations attempt to use Justice Kennedy's significant nexus test as the basis for identifying regulated waters under the Act. So in the areas of tributaries and adjacent wetlands, the 2015 regs basically work like this. All tributaries are included that contribute flow downstream eventually to navigable and fact waters and have a bed and bank and an ordinary high water mark. And this definition allows the regulation of ephemeral drainages. And ephemeral means that it only flows in response to rainfall. An ephemeral drainage is, or ephemeral flow, is basically the rainfall running off the landscape. The 2015 regulations also include intermittent drainages. And so an intermittent drainage flows for longer than merely in direct response to rainfall, but maybe as little as a week or a few days beyond direct response to rainfall. They may flow discontinuously, and they may flow maybe a few different times a year, but not continuously between those times. On adjacent wetlands, the 2015 regulation maintained the 86 regulation framework of bordering, continuous, or neighboring, but it added significant detail to those concepts that attempts to implement the Kennedy significant nexus test. The 2015 regs include a complex definition of neighboring that includes distance thresholds for certain types of wetlands, either 1,500 feet or 4,000 feet from other water bodies, and a series of factors that go into considering whether those water bodies are regulated or not. One of the essences of the significant nexus framework is the aggregation, a collection of wetlands within a region, to determine whether that collection has the requisite nexus with downstream navigable and fact waters, even if any one of those wetlands standing alone would lack the necessary connection. And so the 2015 regulations, I think as most people will be aware, engendered a high amount of controversy during their adoption. EPA was somewhat notoriously found to have sponsored what I understand to be an illegal publicity campaign soliciting through contractors support of public comments for their own regulation. There was an enormous amount of litigation that ensued in the wake of those regulations and is ongoing today. And so these have been both a policy and eventually even a political flashpoint in the 2016 presidential election. And upon taking office in 2017, President Trump directed EPA and the Army Corps to consider a new definition of navigable waters based on the Rapanos plurality rather than the Kennedy concurrence. And so what we got in February of this year is the proposal to implement that direction. And so let me give a quick synopsis of what the plurality, the Rapanos plurality, requires for tributaries and adjacent wetlands. It's much simpler. It's much more concrete than the concurrence. It basically goes like this. For tributaries, the Rapanos plurality would hold that only continuously flowing and relatively permanent non-navigable tributaries, which would in ordinary parlance be called a stream or river, can be regulated under the Act. And on adjacent wetlands, the plurality would hold that wetlands are only subject to the Act if they immediately abut either a navigable river or lake or a regulated non-navigable tributary. And in sort of what they mean by that, the plurality took pains to reference the Supreme Court's prior 1985 decision in Riverside Bayview Homes, in which the court held that a wetland that directly abuts a navigable lake, in that case, in a way that it's actually difficult to draw a line between where the lake ends and the wetland begins. That under circumstances like that, it's reasonable for the agency to include the wetland within the larger water feature for regulatory purposes. And the Rapanos plurality, I think, you know, the fair reading of it is that it limits regulation of wetlands to only those types, wetlands that physically and directly abut another regulated feature, and do so in a way where you can't really draw a line between one and the other. So the EPA's 2019 proposed rule, you know, I'd agree with Darren, it takes an important step in reforming the prior overbroad definitions of tributaries and adjacent wetlands. But there's also some questions about whether it limits itself to just those waters included within the Rapanos plurality. So on tributaries, the 2019 proposal, it carefully defines tributaries as those which provide non-ephemeral flow to a downstream, navigable, in fact, river or lake in a normal year. A normal year is determined generally through a 30-year average, and the result of this is that it excludes ephemeral drainages and features, and that is actually a significant reform over prior definitions. The proposal does not require perennial or even seasonal continuous flow, and so this raises a question under the Rapanos plurality's definition of covered waters as relatively permanent and continuously flowing. So the 2019 proposal does regulate some relatively insignificant drainages that flow intermittently, which may only do so, as with prior iterations of the rule, for a few days or weeks of the year beyond the ephemeral standard. So this category, intermittently flowing but not continuously flowing streams, is a fairly large category of waters that do not seem to meet the Rapanos plurality standard of continuously flowing. Okay. And then on the wetland side, the 2019 proposal only regulates wetlands that directly abut, you know, another regulated water, or... And here, again, is a question whether this is actually within the scope of the Rapanos plurality. It also regulates wetlands that are not directly abutting other regulated waters, but have a non-ephemeral surface flow connection with those other regulated waters. Now, the 2018 proposal also has a very important change in it, which, you know, certainly following its logic of requiring a surface connection, states that wetlands that are separated from other regulated waters by barriers like berms or roads or uplands are not adjacent and therefore not regulated. And this is a reform of all prior agency regulations, which say that those types of barriers do not prevent wetlands from being adjacent. So the 2019 proposal departs from the 86 framework, the bordering, continuous, neighboring, and replaces that kind of qualitative approach with a more quantitative surface connection requirement, and then query whether it allows regulation of wetlands that are farther from other regulated waters than the Rapanos plurality would, which appears to require this tighter, you know, closer connection to the other regulated waters. And then the 2019 proposal also breaks pretty definitively with the 2015 regulations by abandoning Justice Kennedy's complex multi-factor significant nexus determination. So that's a quick trip through how the new rule treats tributaries and adjacent wetlands and how it differs from the 2015 regs and where it may differ somewhat from the Rapanos plurality. Well, I'll hand it back to you, Darren.
Thanks, Tony. And I'm actually going to turn it over to Deirdre to talk about ditches.
Yeah, and it's real easy on ditches to talk about the prior regulations, the 1986 regulations and the 2015 regulations. None of them actually had a category of jurisdictional waters called ditches. And ironically, this administration has proposed a category of jurisdictional waters called ditches. Now, it's not to say that the 2015 rule didn't address ditches as jurisdictional. They put them essentially in the tributary definition. But here, there's a separate tributary category and a separate ditch category. And that's kind of significant for the first time to have one of the categories of WOTUS being considered to be ditches. Under the proposal, ditches would be included as WOTUS if they are traditional navigable waters, which is what I talked about first. So if it meets that, you know, if Appendix D is used, recreational use on a ditch could qualify it as a traditional navigable water. A ditch will also be jurisdictional if it's constructed in or relocates or alters a tributary and meets the tributary definition, or the ditch was constructed in adjacent wetlands and meets the tributary definition. And again, those are the tributary definitions and adjacent wetland definitions under this new proposal. All other ditches would be excluded from the WOTUS definition. The agencies also proposed to define the term ditch as, quote, an artificial channel used to convey water. So an artificial channel used to convey water. So a couple points on this. First, the agency's proposal on what ditches are jurisdictional is very much tied to the tributary definition that Tony talked about, and therefore kind of exactly where the intermittent perennial flow concept is compared to ephemeral. I mean, there needs to be a very clear line between what is intermittent and what is ephemeral. Otherwise, ditches are going to, you know, be caught up in that potential that waters that flow infrequently may get wrapped up in the intermittent category, and therefore ditches may also come in under that as well. Second, the agencies really need to be providing more clarity in this rule on how to determine what is an artificial channel versus a naturally occurring surface water channel. So if something's an artificial channel, it'll be evaluated as a ditch. If it's a naturally occurring surface water channel, it'll be evaluated as a tributary. And that may be obvious, but it's not set forth in the rule. And under the framework that's set forth, this is important because there's really different analysis that's performed depending upon whether a feature is artificial versus natural. A lot of folks, as I said, have considered it pretty problematic to have ditches as a separate jurisdictional category. And so that could result in a lot more confusion and a lot more ditches being regulated. So I think removing it as a separate category would be good and dealing with it more as an exclusion. Further, you know, because the proposed construct of whether a ditch is jurisdictional turns on whether it's constructed in or relocates a tributary or whether it was constructed in an adjacent wetland, this is going to require landowners and regulators to consider the kind of historical conditions under which the ditch was constructed. And there are many, many, many ditches all over the United States, and then many were constructed well before the Clean Water Act and well before tools that were, you know, in existence to help kind of identify what the historic conditions are. So the preamble states that the burden of proof is going to be on the agencies to determine the historic status of the ditch's construction, but I think the public needs more clarity on this point. There are some things that I think the agencies could do to specify that, you know, that applicants or landowners will only be requested to provide, you know, existing documentation, that they don't have to create or gather new information, that they can only request once something from a landowner or not at all. But exactly, you know, what kind of evidence is going to be necessary, how long that is going to take. The agencies could state that there's a time period for making these determinations. For example, you know, the agency has no longer than 60 days from receipt of a request for there to be kind of information provided. But exactly how this determination gets made, the logistics of it, the evidentiary requirements of determining when a ditch was constructed and you know, in what, whether it was in an adjacent wetland or a tributary, is somewhat problematic. Finally, you know, the agencies really should acknowledge that if a ditch is ultimately determined to be excluded, either because the historical information confirms that it, you know, was not constructed under the criteria necessary, or because the agencies are unable to carry their burden, the ditch remains excluded, and they can, you know, have certainty on that, and landowners aren't going to be subjected to kind of perpetual attempts to reassert jurisdiction over that feature. Again, I think there's a lot of implementation issues that this ditch category creates that the agencies need to work through.
Thanks, Deirdre. Before we take questions, did Tony and Deirdre, did either one of you want to respond to each other or have anything else to add before we take questions?
I don't. I think Tony did a good job laying out the tributary and adjacent wetlands categories.
Likewise.
I'll ask a first question here to Tony. So in Rapanos, I think Justice Scalia makes it expressly clear that he would not include intermittent waters. And he kind of lays out, he does explain, in the plurality explain, that there would be certain seasonal waters they might include. How would you recommend the agencies, the EPA and Corps, kind of, should they exclude intermittent waters, and what should they include? How should they define it?
Sure, thanks. I certainly think that if they are trying to develop a regulation that's based on the plurality, they're not able to. I mean, that the plurality does not encompass intermittent waters. You know, the key requirement is continuous flow and relative permanence. And in talking about that, at one point in the opinion, Justice Scalia writes that you can quibble about what precisely, you know, continuous and permanent mean on the ground, but the ordinary presence of water is really a hallmark. There's an important line in there in rejecting the old tributaries version in the 1986 regs, where the plurality says this results in the regulation of what's mostly land, not water. I think to properly read the plurality, you can only regulate, you know, non-navigable tributaries if they are continuously flowing. Now, there is a footnote in the opinion that allows for the regulation of non-navigable tributaries that may be dry during the summer. So there's a couple of different approaches to that. You could have a number of days for which a water body has to continuously flow, you know, and some have proposed 183 days because that's more than half a year and therefore on the side of relatively permanent rather than not permanent. You could probably adopt some kind of variation on that spoke in terms of seasons. So it has to flow for at least two full seasons and parts of another to be covered. But in any of them, to be within the plurality, it has to continuously flow. I think cannot be intermittent. I'm not getting the page numbers, I think, through it right now, but I think there's actually a statement that, you know, the regulation of intermittent water bodies is not, is not encompassed within their view. The other thing is that there's an important qualitative statement made in the plurality, which is that to be regulated, the non-navigable tributary has to be something that, quote, in ordinary parlance would be called a stream or a creek. And I think that's something that's hard to express in a definitional provision in a regulation. But nonetheless, I think it does suggest a size threshold of some sort below which, you know, a normal person walking toward a small trickle in the woods, for example, would not tell whoever they were hiking with, hey, look at that creek there. And yet, you know, there's no size or minimum flow threshold in the proposed rule. So as long as it provides non-ephemeral flow in a normal year, no matter how small it is, it's regulated.
Thanks. Wes, do we have any questions?
We do have one question from the audience. Let's go ahead and go to that caller.
Yeah, my question does relate to the intermittent flow issue, and I'd like to describe for you Florida. It has the St. Johns River that runs through a substantial portion of it, And if you've ever gone over Interstate 4 going to Disney World, you've crossed over the St. John's River. And south of there, the St. John's River peters out into a sea of grass, which could not be considered by anybody to be a river or have a bank or discernible bank. Yet the Army Corps of Engineers' position has been that back in 1870, there was an enterprising lumberman, who was able to drag a barge over this grass using draft horses, fill it with trees, drag it back over the grass, and then deposit it into the St. John's River. And therefore, the sea of grass were navigable waters because they were historically used and capable of being used as a means of transportation and interstate commerce. Now, that having been the background, Rapanos, to me, seems to clearly dictate that this would no longer be navigable waters. And as I look at the regulation, I don't see that obligation being fulfilled. It looks to me like under the regulation, despite what Rapanos says, this sea of grass will continue to be part of the waters of the United States. Do you have any thought about that? Has the regulation accomplished what Justice Scalia attempted to accomplish in Rapanos?
I'm not going to address necessarily whether the regulation accomplishes, you know, what Justice Scalia, I'll leave that to Tony, but with respect to your, you know, hypothetical or actual, to me, it's always hard when you don't have all the details on everything, but it does seem to me that the core, there is this issue on A1 waters that talk about past use. And, you know, this notion that if at one point in the past the area in question was arguably used for, you know, transporting lumber through a barge back and forth, but now that area is no longer navigable, does A1 cover it? And I would say, as currently proposed, I think A1 would cover what you're talking about. Do I think that's right? Do I think there are legal arguments why that's wrong? I think so. But I think it is one of these gray areas in this regulation and in really the issue at large. You know, the Rivers and Harbors Act talks about things being once navigable, always navigable. That's the Rivers and Harbors Act. But the Clean Water Act is really a water quality statute and doesn't have this notion in general of looking back in time as to what something was, you know, many, many years ago. Under this proposal, there are elements of that, as I kind of laid out, both in the A1 concept where you have this notion of past use and also in the ditch category where you're talking about, you know, what was it when it was constructed, and that notion of looking back in time many years ago, I think is potentially problematic.
But I think what I hear you really saying is that you don't think the regulation complies with what the executive order requires, which is conforming the law, the regulations, to Justice Scalia's decision in Rapanos.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at the executive order. I think it gave them some wiggle room.
In a manner consistent with the opinion of Justice Antonin Scalia in Rapanos.
So let me address that quickly. The preamble to the proposal expressly says that what they've tried to do with this regulation is some kind of harmonization between the Kennedy concurrence and the plurality, and the Scalia plurality. I do think that they have a legal problem with approaching it that way. So Rapanos is a fractured decision, meaning there's no majority opinion. Four justices join the plurality in striking down the 1986 regs on tributaries and adjacent wetlands. Justice Kennedy agrees with them, but on a very different rationale. You know, in strict terms, there's no holding of that opinion. So then you turn to the Supreme Court's opinion in Marks versus United States, which provides the lower courts with some guidance on how to interpret and apply fractured decisions. And the general rule there is that you look at the opinions that support the judgments, and if one of them is a logical subset of the others, then that's the holding. But the basic direction of Marks is that one of the opinions may be the holding. One of the opinions supporting the judgment may be the holding. With that, you know, lower courts and executive agencies are not free to try to meld, you know, the two disparate opinions together into yet a third one that was not adopted by any member of the court. And so I think that there's a, you know, a legal defensibility problem for the agencies if they proceed with a regulation that is not based on one or the other. I think they pretty clearly said in the preamble that they have made an effort to try to cohere the two as though they were separate Supreme Court opinions. I mean, it's one thing to say we're going to try to cohere a rule of law out of Riverside Bayview and Solid Waste Agency of Rutherford County and Rapanos. This is what we think the distilled rule is. And that's, you know, what everybody has to do always. But within a single fractured decision, there's absolutely no legal authority for the proposition that the government is then free to pick and choose among the opinions supporting the judgment which elements of each it prefers, and to form those into a third rule that no justice ever put their name to. I think that is a significant issue that the agencies are going to have to face in finalizing this proposal.
Let me just say, I agree with everything that you just said. The only thing that I would graft onto that is, you know, chief law enforcement officer of the United States, the president, has made a choice. And he said that among all of these rationales for the decision, we choose Scalia's and Thomas. And it doesn't seem to me like the Army Corps and the EPA have followed that instruction. They've done what you've suggested, which is try to meld together a number of different portions of the plurality opinion. And therefore, the rule doesn't really follow the instructions of the executive order. Am I wrong?
This is Darren. Just a couple of points. First of all, I don't disagree with you on whether or not I don't think it's consistent with the plurality in Rapanos. I mean, I think that whole intermittent water question kind of got to that, the fact that it's not limited to the relatively permanent waters. But I don't believe that the executive order simply directs them that they have to follow Rapanos. And the other thing that I would be concerned about, and I have been concerned about, is the agencies need to be able to, they need to figure out what the Constitution and the Clean Water Act require. The executive order itself shouldn't be directing the answer to the question. It certainly can inform and play a role. And as far as I recall, the executive order asked the agencies to go back, look at the 2015 Clean Water Rule and potentially revise it, you know, potentially consistent with the Scalia plurality opinion. And they have to a large extent, they have. So, but to a large extent, they haven't. So I think that's kind of where we're at. Wes, do we have any other questions?
We do not have any other questions at this time. Darren, I turn the mic back to you. Do you have any more questions for our panelists?
Yeah, I do have a question for Deidre. On one of the questions regarding traditional navigable waters is the susceptible to use language. Do you have any suggestions on how susceptible to use should be addressed?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are cases that have, again, in the Rivers and Harbors Act, because that language really is grounded in the Rivers and Harbors Act, it needs to be susceptible to use with transportation of interstate commerce with reasonable improvement. And I think there are cases that talk about it, you know, there needing to be actual plans, and it can't just be that the agencies say, regardless of cost, regardless of, it has to have kind of concrete plans associated with respect to its reasonable susceptibility. So, again, I think this part of the regulation, to the extent it can be grounded more in the Rivers and Harbors Act kind of traditional view of what that means, it will be better than the way it is currently written, which is potentially its own language and subject to interpretation, problematic interpretation by the agencies. So I think the more the agencies can clarify that this is grounded in the Rivers and Harbors Act case law, the better this is going to be. To the extent it's a new kind of open-ended Clean Water Act definition, which is what it has been kind of in the past couple of years through Appendix D. It's morphed into being overbroad, and I do think the susceptible to use to transportation of commerce is problematic in that.
So, Wes, I did have one thing I wanted to mention briefly. Your announcement of the next teleforum reminded me of this. If you're interested in the topic that we've been discussing today, on May 8th at the Federal Society's Executive Branch Review Conference in Washington, D.C., we'll have a breakout panel on this topic that will feature Jeff Clark, who's the Assistant Attorney General for the Environment and Natural Resources Division at the Justice Department, which is, for a lot of practical purposes, if you will, the not perhaps the proponent of the rule, but certainly counsel to the agencies in preparing the rule. We'll also be joined by John Devine, who's an attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council, which has been very critical of the proposed rule. I'll be on the panel, and we'll be moderated by Professor Jonathan Adler. And so if this is of interest to you, I think that panel will also be very interesting. That'll be May 8th.
Thanks, Tony. All right, Wes, any more questions?
We do have one more from the audience.
Okay, good.
Audience caller, you are up.
Okay, sorry, this might be a bit of a peculiar question or outside of the scope of the conversation, but in regards to this rule, do you think that it's under this rule or under the Clean Air Act that fireworks detonating over intercoastal waterways that release pollutants, would that be something that you think this is regulating or that would be found under the Clean Air Act? Because I wasn't sure if the particulates eventually finding their way into the waterway was actually something that would be defined within this as a pollutant that's being detonated by a point source, or if you think that because of the air, it wouldn't necessarily be the same.
Deirdre, do you have any thoughts on
well,
that?
Well, no, actually, I do know that fireworks have been determined to be, you know, discharges of pollutants into waters in the past, requiring permits. So that's not, I mean, I can't speak to the Air Act requirements. It may end up being that it has implications for both, but I'm pretty sure, and I, you know, this has come up in the past that fireworks detonating kind of over waters can be considered point source discharges into waters.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Tony and Deirdre and Wes.
Wonderful. Well, everyone, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We do want to let you all know, again, pointing at what Tony was mentioning, we do have our Executive Branch Review Conference on May 8th. That's going to be at the Mayflower Hotel in D.C., and it's completely free with a fee for CLE if you'd like some. So we hope to see you there, but thank you very much for tuning in to this or the podcast. We hope to hear from you all soon. Thank you for joining. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.